Hello, and welcome to Building Sustainability Podcast. I'm your host, Geoffrey Hart, aka Geoffrey the Natural Builder. Building Sustainability consists of conversations with designers, builders, makers, dreamers, and doers, exploring the wide world of sustainability in the built environment by talking to wonderful people who are doing excellent things. Hello, welcome to episode 56 of the Building Sustainability Podcast. This week, we are talking to Daniel Postma about turf houses. I want to start very quickly just by saying apologies for being a bit late on this episode. I've got a lot going on, haven't I? I've got one really big project that is just coming into fruition. It's big and it's very visible and is a really great step for natural materials. I can't say much more than that, but as soon as I can, you will be sure to hear about it. In fact, I might try and get some of the people involved on the podcast to talk about what they've done and why. What else to tell you? Daniel talks later about workshops that he has got going on. So if you're listening to this and you think, turf building, that is what I want to know about, and you can get yourself to Scotland, then make sure you check out the links in the show notes for those workshops. There are two videos that you should watch. They are recordings from, first of all, the ACAN, Architects Climate Action Network. They did a special presentation on straw as a building material. That is definitely worth checking out. It's got the who's who, including Craig White, our last guest. So that's a very good thing to watch. Also, the European Straw Bale Gathering. The video from the UK section is available now, so links to that in the show notes. You can see me do a presentation on earth and straw, which takes actually a large chunk of what I talk about from this podcast. It also includes a terrible pun. What else to say? Other things. I'm talking really fast because this is quite a long episode and I had to cut out 25 minutes, which is all available on the Patreon site. And that takes the total amount of extra audio up to over 8.5 hours now. So yeah, maybe get involved and be part of that. And that is exactly what Lawrence Luscombe, Niall Hall and Megan Jackson have done. Thank you to those three for their support. It really does mean a lot. And a big shout out to Ivan, who has increased his support and is now getting himself a hand-carved wooden spoon. Nice. Part of the money that the Patreon money goes towards is getting me new equipment. And this episode now is being recorded on my brand new microphone, which is a special one, so that I can go and do some field recordings. I've got a couple of events coming up that I want to go out and talk to people out in the field, literally in a field, and this microphone's going to enable us to do that. So yes, that's the sort of thing you need to invest in and cost money. But I've gone on enough about Patreon for ages now. So what else can I tell you? Oh yes, the prize draw. Kirsten sent me an email to say thank you very much that she just won. Although she lives in Australia and felt like it would be not a good use of sort of postage and shipping things to send her the prizes. So we have redrawn the prize and now Simon Lovett, you have won. Congratulations. Right, what else to tell you? Oh, so yes, this episode starts off with a section that Daniel suggested we start with. It's borrowed from the Guilty Feminist podcast. I'm a natural builder, I think it's quite nice to start with some of our failings and how everyone isn't perfect. And we can all be doing better at sustainability. So yeah, I really hope you enjoy this. I had a really nice time chatting to Daniel. He is a hugely entertaining and lovely human being. So thank you so much to Daniel. And I think that's everything I need to say. So enjoy.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Hall, host of Sustainable Futures, Kantar's regular look at the intersection between brands, consumers, and sustainability. I want to help you to get your brand ready for the future, understand where you can make an impact, and make a smarter business case for products and services that are better for people, the planet, and for business. Sustainable Futures will showcase what great sustainable marketing looks like and the issues that matter to consumers across the globe. Subscribe to Sustainable Futures from Kantar, wherever you get your podcasts.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I'm a natural builder, but we have two cars, both of which are diesels.
Yes. Yes. Do you know what? That was actually going to be one of mine. And realizing that, I mean, I've now moved to the country. When I lived in Bristol, I didn't have a car. I cycled everywhere. And now, like, I'm living the more countryside, you know, eco life. And it doesn't work that way. I now drive a big diesel van.
Yeah. Being in the countryside is definitely part of our excuse.
Yeah.
The fact that these cars are diesels doesn't, there's no real excuse for that.
Well, diesels are better for, they run longer, and so they are better in a sort of embodied energy way. But I think they're just worse for humans breathing it.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So they're both second hands, and we do keep our cars for a very long time, and I think we've spent more on repairs, certainly for one of the cars, than the actual purchase value.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. I think that's well justified, I think. And I've seen now that I mean, so in Bristol and in Bath, they're starting to charge people who drive diesels. And I find it so annoying because it's, yeah, they've encouraged everyone to get diesels. And now they're saying, actually, you know, you shouldn't have diesels, so we're going to charge you. But they're not subsidizing the alternatives, like the, you know, where are all the electric car subsidies and the electric van subsidies?
Yeah. Yeah. They're high on our wish list. But, there's supplies attached to them.
Quite a big one.
Yeah, and many questions with regard to the production and embodied energy of new build cars.
Yeah.
So we're just biding our time and keeping these cars running for as long as possible.
Good, nice. So I'm a natural builder, but right now I am wrapping my house in plastic and taping it shut with more plastic. And the tape comes with a little layer of plastic that you have to peel off and discard. And it makes me feel dirty.
Yeah, what do you do?
Yeah.
It's a discussion that's featured in some of your earlier podcasts, which was terribly interesting, and it's good to see both sides of the argument.
Definitely.
Featuring.
It's weird for me because I'm used to wrapping a building in plaster and, you know, some lime or some clay to make it airtight. And now I'm doing a totally timber building. It's like, what do you, yeah, you sort of have to if you want to get high performance.
And it seems from what I've understood for this particular building that with the walls being so thin, it's the high performance that has become a priority.
You don't
have the luxury of building 60 centimeter thick walls.
Exactly, yeah. I could, but I don't think there'd be any room for anything else, really.
Micro house rather than a tiny house.
Yes.
I'm a natural builder, but given the choice, I prefer to drive the less economic 4x4.
Oof. Crikey, that is a... That's a... Can you justify that?
No, no, there's no justification. It's just pure enjoyment. Yeah, so sometimes I can if we're crossing a ford or going out in the countryside. Sometimes, of course, for work. If I need to carry a trailer load of turf out of a boggy field,
yeah,
I feel it's justified. Yeah, because I'd probably need to bring in a crane to get the two-wheel drive out if I chance that.
Yeah.
Other than that, no, that's, yeah.
Do you find yourself like making sure that you go across a ford just to justify driving the big 4x4?
No, thankfully not. No, no. The only sort of additional push there is the kid saying, can we please take the 4x4?
Yeah.
They don't enjoy the other one. It's got darkened windows and they sit a bit lower down. And the suspension's so much better that you just sort of float across these country roads and it makes them nauseous. So they prefer the other car too.
Yes.
We don't drive a lot though. So
all right. So I'm a natural builder, but for a while, I stopped recycling because that I feel bad. And I've told a few people this and they've gone, what? But it was when I realized that we were just shipping all our recycling to Indonesia or somewhere like that. And I thought, if I put it in this bin, I'm creating like this whole other thing and sort of sending our problem off. Or if I put it in this bin, then we're having to deal with it as our own country. And it lasted about, I mean, it was a few months where I did that. And I'm back on the recycling train again now. You'll be pleased to know.
It's interesting to hear that, though. Yeah, the international export of our reusables, or reusable materials,
yeah,
is something that's I've spotted and that has raised some concerns. Is there a movement? Do you know? Is there a movement of people that are sort of deliberately
I don't know,
recycling?
It seems like the sort of base level of sustainability, isn't it? It's like the sort of social, you know, but I recycle. I'm a good person.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I've not met anyone else that's sort of done it for the same reasons as me. I've met some people that are just lazy.
We found that a big difference coming over from the Netherlands, where recycling has really taken off. And we had a different bin for everything. And as far as I understand, that was all processed, maybe not all, but most of it within the country.
Mm-hmm.
And we could, when it came to plastics, we could chuck about just about anything into the plastics recycling bin. And here we all need to sort of, some plastics can go in, some can't, needs to be washed,
yeah,
needs to be cleaned. There's certainly a bigger threshold. And some things we just can't recycle. We had turpentine that we was left in our house when we bought it. Turpentine and, in fact, a whole barrel of fluid DPC.
Okay.
For injecting DPC, damp-proof coursing, in masonry walls, which, of course, we don't have any use for. So we were looking for a way to get rid of this. And at one point, I was laughed at by a council employee for suggesting that I'd bring my flammable turpentine to their recycling center. And they said, well, no, we can't accept that because it's flammable material.
So it's cardboard.
So I never got an answer. I think the only solution that, well, it wasn't said out loud, but the only real solution was to flush it down the toilet, it seemed.
Right.
So that's an unresolved issue, along with where to recycle our fire extinguisher, which we've never found an answer to.
Well, I guess if anyone in your area needs some turpentine, we'll put Daniel's contact details.
We're gradually using it to light the fire. Whenever we put the fire pit on in the garden, we'll use a splash of turpentine to get it going. We've got a jerrycan full of it, so it'll last us a fair while.
I bet, yeah.
I'm a natural builder, but our previous house was a concrete and brick urban new build that replaced an earlier concrete and brick new build that had only been there for 40 years before it was demolished.
Ooh. Was it, did you do the demolishing? Was it just that?
We didn't do the demolishing, no. Though I think we're in part responsible because the developer that did it and then, or had it done, and then built the new builds, we gave them a whole load of, we gave them a lot of money.
Mm.
For their product. So, yeah.
What, do you feel like, would it have happened if you hadn't have given them the money? Do you feel, or do you feel like you're just sort of being part of the sort of economic system that means that still happens?
It would definitely still have happened if we, as individuals, wouldn't have given them the money.
Yeah.
But that's not an excuse.
Mm-hmm.
Because unless we all stand up against, yeah, or stand up for our principles, nothing will change, will it? So, yeah.
That's very true.
My only excuse there was naivety.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, but looking back on it, I think, yeah, well, we were part of that system.
Yeah.
We paid somebody for that work. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ah. I'm a natural builder, but I'm building a house on a big hunk of metal, a big, expensive for me, expensive for the environment. Yeah, that, like, I've calculated how much carbon the insulation in my walls is going to take out of the atmosphere, but I haven't yet calculated how much the carbon that's in the metal is going to put in. I mean, I don't think this build will be sequestering carbon, like, in a net way. I think it's, yeah. I mean, I think it will be not the worst, but I'm definitely not hitting that, like, high bar I set myself.
Is that a difficult decision for you to make? Or is it, because I think it's an experiment, isn't it, what you're trying to achieve with this,
yeah,
with this build?
It is. I mean, it's all about the compromise, isn't it? And it's about, because I want something, I almost said need, but I don't think that's true. Because I want something that's mobile, and yeah, that's sort of the way to create mobility, or it's a way. Yeah, it's difficult to swallow.
We have a similar issue here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a natural builder, but our current house is a poorly insulated static caravan, which we're heating with gas from cylinders and electric heaters.
Yeah. Yeah, I can appreciate that. I'm living in a very damp caravan at the moment.
I didn't say it was damp.
Oh.
It is, of course, when there's condensation. Though we knew we'd be in it for a couple of years with the family.
Yeah.
So we did seek out quite a sturdy one with double glazing and central heating.
That's all right then.
So in terms of comfort, we're okay.
Yeah.
But still, it does embody many things that we're trying to move away from.
Yeah. Well, it's a temporary home. I mean, it's while you're renovating your sort of main house, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you're doing that all in good ways, because we're going to talk about that today.
Yeah, as much as we can. Yeah, certainly.
Sweet. Well, I guess I try not to go in for the sort of tell me about your background question. But I think for you, it's really interesting because you've come into natural building from in my mind, quite a sort of obscure route.
Yeah, certainly an unconventional route, I think. I think most of my route into natural building, and in that sense, my background, it's mostly about turf. So if we're going to talk about turf anyway,
yeah,
I might as well set out a bit of the background. I was born in Scotland, but we moved to the Netherlands when I was 20 months old. So I've grown up in the Netherlands, mm-hmm. But that link to the UK has always been there. And then fast forward to my studies in archaeology. When I was doing my master's degree in the Netherlands, a local heritage museum came up with the idea to reconstruct an early medieval turf house for which plans had been excavated in the area. In fact, there were quite a few excavations that had produced these early medieval ground plans.
Mm-hmm. What were they finding there?
The lower sections of surviving turf walls. This area in the north of the Netherlands in particular used to be a wide salt marsh up to 10 or 20 kilometers in width. Mm-hmm. And not having any natural heights or timber for that matter, people had to adapt to quite an extreme measure in order to live there.
Uh-huh.
It was excellent grassland, so it was great for cattle rearing. And in fact, that's where the Frisian Empire reached its height.
Uh-huh.
With wide international trade and so on. So it was a wealthy period in a fertile region, as long as you managed to adapt to the environmental conditions there. And they did that in a way of raising artificial settlement mounds so you could live on a dry spot when the area flooded up to about 50 times a year. And part of that raising of the settlement was done by building houses with thick turf walls, so cutting turf blocks from the surrounding grassland and stacking them up in some fashion to produce about a meter thick walls for their longhouses. And quite a remarkable type of structure that got the attention of local archaeologists. Mm-hmm. Already in the 1940s, and various other excavations had been executed and produced more of these house plans. But until this local museum raised the question of what these buildings actually looked like, nobody really sat down to think about that part of the whole equation. We were just looking at the ground plans, and many of the sites in the Netherlands are truncated sites, so where the top of the archaeological settlements has actually been ploughed out. So the tradition of researching archaeological ground plans was very much one geared towards just documenting the plans and comparing these from a typological point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So how lengths and widths and interior divisions developed over time, but never given much thought to how they actually functioned in a technical sense. So, of course, when you want to reconstruct one, you get confronted with all these technical challenges. And with regard to turf walls, for example, can you even build a wall with turf? Will it stand up? There were quite a few leads in earlier archaeological publications for that region. And they were all very similar. Everybody seemed to agree that you couldn't build a turf wall up to over about a meter in height. It would have to grow green again, because it's the roots that keep the turf together. You'd probably need quite a batter to the wall in order for it to be stable. They certainly can't be load-bearing. So I was following all these various leads for my my master's thesis in order to produce a reconstruction model for this museum then to build. And as I was doing that, it transpired that not only were all the buildings in that particular period, so 5th, 6th, 7th century AD, built with turf, regardless of their sort of social status. So it certainly wasn't a material that was just used by the poorer layers of society. Mm-hmm. The elites were using them too. They also turned out to be built with load-bearing turf walls. This raised a lot of questions in terms of what you can actually achieve with turf. And as I started looking around, I came across other examples, in part through links to Scotland.
Uh-huh.
Bruce Walker in particular, a vernacular specialist at the time, working in Scotland, who had published on turf and on longhouses more generally, and the timber structures that were associated with them, and the thatching. And he had these examples from Nebraska in the United States that showed a two-story turf-walled house. And I came across turf domes in Iceland and all these sorts of wonderful load-bearing turf structures, and certainly a wide variety in terms of techniques and quality. and turf use in various social contexts, for religious buildings and pastoral farms.
Mm-hmm.
So this really clashed with our existing sort of ideas about turf use in the Netherlands in the past. And I think I'm just naturally drawn to things that don't seem to line up. If somebody says, well, you can't do that with turf, I just think, well, I've seen this one example out there that sort of argues the opposite, so I'll follow that one example that doesn't fit in.
Yeah.
Because apparently something more is going on than what we're seeing. So needless to say, it took about 2 years to finish that master's thesis. But it did develop into a PhD project that still is unfinished, but we did go through all the motions. And as part of that PhD project, we built an experimental turf house. I actually built the turf house that this museum set out to reconstruct.
Oh, great.
Myself, with a whole team of volunteers, of course. So that was a wonderful project, and that set out to test this idea of load-bearing turf walls, not so much to test if it could be done, because we already established on the basis of the ground plans that it had been done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So this experiment really became about trying to figure out how they managed to achieve that.
Yeah. Nice.
So I didn't succeed, though, the first time.
Oh, no.
The building collapsed, unfortunately.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, well, tell us about that, because I think, learning from mistakes is kind of key, isn't it? So.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was, in a way, of great benefit to the research project. Of course, it wasn't desirable at all, and it was, in fact, a great risk. And we didn't, thankfully, nobody got hurt in that process.
Mm-hmm.
Other than my ego, I think everything was fine. And thankfully, there was great support from the local, so the provinces and mm-hmm. the council and from the university. So we did get the opportunity to do it again. And the second building's still there and in use exactly as it was intended to be.
Yeah.
So the reason for the collapse was really just inexperience and making mistakes. As you do when you try things the first time, and particularly a combination of errors occurring in a particular part of the building that after heavy rainfall brought it down.
Uh-huh.
Thankfully enough of the structure survived. We actually did a little excavation in the collapsed structure and we managed to figure out exactly how and where it starts to come down.
Nice. Oh, that's good. You got to do some archaeology on a modern building.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that was really good. And it produced a lot of, as we say in archaeology, it's experimental archaeology as you try and reconstruct a building like this with the objective of producing information on the process and use of materials.
Sure.
But I think the biggest benefit was really through experiential archaeology, which is just experiencing the use of these materials, handling them, and going through the motions of cutting the turf and shifting it around and experiencing firsthand the differences between silt and clay content and when do the turfs break and why do we actually build them with the grass side down?
Right.
These sort of questions.
Uh-huh. And I guess sort of learning like how big of a piece of turf is a manageable by a sort of person, or is it a team game to build it? Is it,
Absolutely.
How much of that sort of knowledge existed in the sort of existing buildings, and how much were you figuring out as you went?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Mick from the Mick and Pat Show.
That's right, and I'm Pat.
Looking for a podcast that's like catching up with old friends? Well, you're in luck.
We're here to bring you weekly doses of lifestyle commentary, discuss culture and politics, and top it off with the occasional beer and film reviews.
But it's not just about us. We're a community. Our listeners are our kin, and we let you all have a say in what we discuss.
So saddle up and join the conversation at the Mick and Pat Show. You can check out our website or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
I a lot of information, I think, still exists in surviving buildings, though very few buildings with turf survive in Scotland at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And although quite a few had been published on by this Bruce Walker in the past, it didn't really drill into the technicalities of it. It did set out sort of variations in maybe choice of materials, whether it's a peaty turf or more of a silty turf, or whether it has clay in it, but how that affects, for example, your bonding patterns, or whether or not it can be a load-bearing wall. That's never been part of the research. It's very much been a sort of first exploration of turf as a building material, to the point that it did raise awareness amongst archaeologists in Scotland in particular, that turf was a widely used building material in the past. And there were various survey projects on the go just as I started my master's research. And I bumped into somebody, Brian Wilkinson, who was, for what is now Historic Environment Scotland, was involved with Rural Past, Scotland's Rural Past, a survey project, community based, or at least involving a lot of community members in surveying surviving buildings, or building remains rather, throughout the Scottish countryside. And him being aware that a lot of turf was used in the construction of these buildings, he'd developed stronger links with a turf building school in Iceland, and went there himself to learn about turf in from a practical point of view. And he pointed me towards that same school, for which I'm ever thankful for, because I managed to get a small fund from a university at the time and went over there. That was back in 2009. And did this turf building course, and that completely slashed all the preconceptions we had about turf, that the walls need to be green. They were saying, no, you don't want them to go green, because at the best, in the best case, that would maybe keep the outer 10 or 20 centimetres densely rooted. But the wall, if the wall's a metre thick, the remainder of the wall will just remain moist, and the roots in there will start to mould and decay. So in fact, you want the wall to dry out, much like you would do with a cob or a mud wall.
Okay, so it's sort of like making adobes almost. It's
very much so, yeah. And certainly the salt marsh turf that we cut in the Netherlands for this reconstruction had so much clay in it, and it was so densely layered with clay and silt, and it actually had very, very little root matter in it, that it was very much like a mud block, more perhaps than you'd expect a piece of turf to be.
Yeah, I was trying to think about the process and what I know about turf, and I was thinking about it like a mud block with a really good fibre content in it. Like we'd probably put a straw or something in a clay block. But yeah, you've got the natural roots.
It's all there. Yeah, that's definitely an ideal mix. If you can get that mixture between clays and maybe some sort of aggregate and your fibres,
yeah,
that's an ideal building block.
I suppose what's interesting is that we, as clay builders or earth builders, would definitely try to stay away from topsoil. And you're kind of going in for the topsoil there.
Yeah. Turf is definitely the odd one out. Mm. And from a modern perspective, I should add.
Yeah.
So I think, and that's definitely something that shines through in some of your earlier podcasts, so listeners will be familiar with that. Maybe what you're looking for in terms of earth construction. You dig down to your subsoil, which doesn't have any seeds that are going to sprout in your plasterwork. It doesn't have any worms crawling out of your mud wall. So this is this nice, sterile soil that you find underneath the top layer. And then you add in fibres, if you choose to do so, and you go for a nice, strong straw. And then these turf builders come along, and they just, like, the part that any other earth builder would cast aside, digging down to their subsoil, that's the part that the turf builder uses.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't use straw in the turf. We don't even use hay in the turf. Our hay is still alive and kicking. It's live grassroots that are in there. And there's all sorts of creepy crawlies in there. So yeah, so it seems to be quite different from earth building in that respect. It only really starts making sense when you look into the history of earth building and realize that that hay and maybe not so much topsoil, but sort of dirty mixes were very common in the past. And that's certainly something that Becky Little is raising awareness for, because it's important for building conservation.
Yeah.
Silts were used. Silt doesn't really seem to have any sort of use in earth building nowadays. It's not an aggregate. It doesn't really give that compressive strength that sand might do. It doesn't function as a binder like clay would do. So what's the use of silt? A lot of turf has silt in it.
Yeah.
And from experiential use, it seems to be good for the flexibility of the turf.
Yeah.
In particular.
So I think it's sort of coming into my mind is that maybe that this is a hypothesis that you can either crush or amend. It seems like turf building was maybe more popular in a time before kind of maybe digging tools got, like, it became possible to dig down further. And my sort of experience of turf building is really only those really old type ones in like Iceland and places like that. And it definitely seems like to my sort of outside perspective that turf building, you know, has died out for much longer than, say, earth building has.
Yeah. In Scotland, there's quite a distinct end to the practice of building in turf, which came about through agricultural improvement. So that's only really about 200 years ago.
Okay, so that's pretty recent.
Up to that point, late 18th century travellers' reports report widely on the use of turf. I actually found another one just yesterday, which was great. I think that was from a military report in the Highlands, in the Badenoch area. And here it was reported that the townships, well, first of all, that no stone buildings were present in that area, although it was quite widely populated, implying everything was built in earth. And then they reported as they approached one of these townships, they seemed to be sort of very well populated with many buildings there, until they came in more closely and realized that a lot of these buildings were actually derelict. And that was due to the practice, which was included in this description, that as a building was reaching its end, it was perhaps first used as a byre, downcycled from a dwelling to a byre or a hen house or something like that, more of a for livestock or as a shed for agricultural use. And then as it really was beyond repair, they would take out the timber structure for reuse in a new building, and the walls were used as a kale yard, having been, of course, enriched with all the livestock droppings inside. So, yeah, a wonderful circular use of a building material, or in fact a whole building type, closely linked into the agricultural cycle there, and it survived certainly in the on the Scottish west coast for a bit longer, in particular with regards to thatching, where thatch would have been raked off sometimes annually to be used as a fertilizer.
Oh wow!
So close links between land use and the way you build, which of course is something that we're now trying to achieve in modern times. Certainly it has caught the interest of many people, but we're looking towards modern solutions to achieve that. And I think what's interesting from an archaeological perspective is that you start to realize we've already been there. We've tried this in the past. It was actually quite successful, but we've moved away from it because of enlightenment and what's come to be known as improvements. It was really the improvements for landowners, of course, who, by reducing maintenance on natural buildings, freed up more time for labor, and thereby induced, increased their profits.
Uh-huh.
So, from late 1700s and early 19th century, there was a distinct shift towards stone buildings, which just lasted longer.
Yeah,
and reduced the maintenance needs, and of course slate roofs or pantile roofs. Moving away from thatching practices.
Sort of going into a much more permanent style of building.
Yeah, yeah. And the great thing is that it's also been reported by occupants that this wasn't seen as an improvement to them.
Right.
Not in terms of comfort, and sometimes even maybe grannies who refused to go into their white house and would stay in their turf-built, buy a house, yeah, because it was just so much more comfortable. There's even interesting shifts in perception between the old statistical accounts in Scotland and the new statistical accounts. And an article was published on that just a couple of years ago by researchers from the University of Stirling, who looked at the perception of earth as a building material and saw that in the older statistical accounts. So this was basically a recording of all economic activity that was going on in the Scottish countryside. And it was quite often commented on the good quality of the buildings, or at least if they were well maintained and in good condition. And the overall impression of it is that these buildings were generally good and in a good condition and looked after. And that's flipped in the second edition, where people the comments are more along the lines of too many people really are still living in these old hovels, which of course was the trailing layer in society that struggled either to go along with these so-called improvements towards stone-built dwellings, or for other reasons held on to their earth structures. But of course, worse at the same time, their options to keep up with maintenance was reduced, and they struggled. And of course, these buildings start to fall in disrepair, and that's that last stage of poorly maintained, collapsing earth buildings is the image that we're left with mm-hmm. at the end of their life. And that's a principle that applies widely. It certainly applies to the turf houses in Iceland and to the turf-built squatter cabins that we had in the Netherlands until fairly recently.
Yeah.
Even up to the point that photography became available, and journalists went into the Dutch countryside to record these collapsing, dirty, turf-built hovels. But it's not... We can't really blame the materials. It's this the economic and social environment in which they were last used that has caused these detrimental living standards. It's not inherent to the material itself. Yeah, the same for any earth building material.
The parallels with how people see cob as this sort of old fashioned dirty way of living. I must admit, I'm slightly I've got this slight little prejudice in me, I guess it is, where I'm thinking living in a turf building must be like dirty. But it's just that same. I'm just applying
exactly
the same mentality.
That's really just the legacy of the propaganda, the improvement propaganda that was kindled about 200 years ago. This is the legacy of it that we're left with. And of course, we can only change that by showing that the opposite is also possible.
Nice. Do you have any kind of accounts of what they were actually like? What did people like about living in them, and what were the sort of benefits?
There's occasional accounts. I think it's mostly the comfort level, the insulation value, effectively. They were dry, comfortable. I think, although that I don't think that's been expressed much. Of course, there's a close link between the people that live in them and the people that built them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they're a product of the landscape. So I think maybe we're only now, in the current day and age, finding the vocabulary to put into words what appeals to us in vernacular structures and more of a traditional building type. And what's that weird feeling we get when we look at modern development? A lot of people feel it, but we don't really have the words for it at this moment to really describe what we dislike.
Mm-hmm.
It's still very sort of guttural feeling for many. And of course, at that time, people really didn't have that vocabulary at all. They were just told that their turf house was well out of date and it was substandard, and they needed to move into this stone-built dwelling that was, in many cases, provided for them. But most of the accounts that deal with turf dwellings are traveler accounts. So okay. These are quite often wealthy, mostly Englishmen traveling north to see this primitive Scottish Highlander in his turf hall.
Right.
So, of course, they're fairly biased.
Yes, of course.
Some are surprised at the size or the comfort of them, but that's rare. A lot of the reports are fairly negative.
Yeah. Gone into it with that mindset of I'm going to look at these lesser people.
Yeah, exactly. And it's more than other building materials, even earth building materials. It's something that requires a lot of upkeep and maintenance. It's a very flexible thing. It's always quite close to nature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's very evident in Iceland and the struggles they're having in Iceland to get their turf buildings recognized as World Heritage, because they're not the same building they were when they were first constructed. There's turf farms that are 300 or 350 years old, but there's very few materials in that building that are of the same age, because it's constantly maintained and adapted to changes in use.
Yeah.
Which turf lends itself for very well, and that's in part why it serves so well as part of that agricultural cycle that we've described as part of a kale yard towards the end of its life. But it's not something that works very well within our modern paradigm.
Yeah.
So, of course, people, when you see that, you see a turf building at a certain stage in that process. So that it can reflect quite poorly on the materials. And you only really learn to appreciate that if you zoom out and see the wider picture.
Sure.
Yeah. And the benefits that it brings. Yeah. And archaeology is a great means of achieving that, because you've got that time depth. And then you see... Well, for me, at least, it started with these turf houses in these few centuries in the north coast of the Netherlands. But then as you follow the various leads, you realize it was used throughout the North Sea and North Atlantic region and for various layers of society. There's 80-meter-long turf holes in the Lofoten in Norway. There's pastoral farms built of turf in Iceland. There's two-story houses in Soddy's in Nebraska. There's a lot more going on here with this material, and also so that's just in geographical times, really, but also from a chronological perspective. We see the turf used in buildings from the Bronze Age onwards, and you refer to the use of tools to build a turf house. Certainly the way I go about it now and the way they did in Scotland in the recent past and in Iceland until today, you need iron tools for that. You need a good spade and an undercutting spade to lift the block out of the ground. Tools they didn't have in the Bronze Age, and for most part they didn't have in the Iron Age. And so they had to go about differently cutting these turfs, and that produced a wide variety of different techniques. So turf early on, prehistoric times, was encased in a formwork. So you maybe have a wattle formwork with or without a daub finish, and turf was packed in between these double wattle walls. So it wasn't a sort of self-supporting turf structure, but as techniques developed and tools developed, you get other options. And certainly in Iceland, I think the variety of turf techniques is huge. You've got these lovely herringbone patterns, which are quite famous. You see them in many touristy photographs of Iceland. It's a wonderful herringbone pattern in the wall. Well, there's a whole range. There's certainly, I think, about four or five different types of turf block that would produce a similar design.
Yeah.
And the choice for each block, it can be down to personal preferences, but generally it's down to the material you have available to you.
I remember when I first saw you talk about turf building back at Clayfest. Whoa, that was 5 or 6 years ago, I think.
That must have been in Oh, no, that was in Cumbria then, I suppose.
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was indeed, yeah. But I was really surprised by the seeing that herringbone pattern, because I just imagined, you know, you cut a lump of turf out, you lay it flat, and then you put the next one on top of it. To see actually them going in at angles was a complete, like, my brain would, I don't think, have ever thought of that. If, you know, if I was going in and trying to recreate this house that you built, I would have, yeah, never found that as an option.
The reconstruction that we made in the Netherlands used fairly simple rectangular blocks, about half a meter in length for the first building, 25 centimeters wide and about 8 centimeters thick. So that was fairly straightforward in terms of bonding patterns and stacking.
Were they laid flat, or were they?
These were laid flat and upside down. We know they were placed upside down because of the various archaeological observations that we've made in the area. But it was really through going to Iceland that we learned that perhaps laying them upside down discourages the grass to regenerate. So it will effectively allow the wall to dry out a lot better. Which is what we're trying to achieve. But also, we found during the construction, it makes it very easy to level each course because it's just soil at the underside of the turf. So running your spade over each course is a great preparation for the next course. You avoid any hollows or cavities in the turf. Turf is a flexible material, and you need to allow for some settlement of the turf. It might shrink a little, certainly if it has a high organic content or if it's very clay rich, it will shrink, and that puts pressure on the corners. The wall head comes down a bit. But any cavities within the wall will over time fill in. And if these are, well, these can create all sorts of unexpected settlement issues. So it's something you try to avoid. And that really works best if you put the turfs upside down and then level them off before you put on the next course.
Yeah.
And then with the herringbone pattern, effectively the same principle is used. The course is trimmed and then they put on the next course. The herringbone pattern really seems to work well as an economic way of building. Certainly the ones that are used most widely in the north of Iceland, they have a sort of tail shape. The angle at which they're cut goes off in different directions. So if they're angled when you see them in the wall face, but if you see the wall in cross section, you'll notice that they also sort of thin out towards the center of the wall. And Icelandic walls, or at least these are, they have an inner and an outer wall face, and the core of the wall is made of compacted earth. So all your spoil, all your trimmings can go into this wall core and are compacted, which is a very economic use of the materials that you've dug up for building.
Wow. I love talking to you about this because, every time I'm just blown away by it's partly because of my assumptions. I assume that it's a very simple thing. It's very, you know, it's quite obvious. And then you start talking about some of the really interesting little sort of details. And it's of course, it's a whole world. And as soon as you zoom in, it's you know, you can get deeper and deeper into these little minute details.
I mean, after a while, you think you've seen most varieties, and then quite recently, we've intensified our work together with archaeologists from the University of Edinburgh, who have been researching the use of turf for fortifications in the Roman Empire. Mm. And they came up with these wonderful examples of mortar, clay mortars being used in combination with turf construction, and branches layered in between as a sort of reinforcement. And it makes perfect sense if you're using this for fortifications. You need a lot of volume. You're looking for volume more than anything. So having to trim down each layer of your turf is a waste of energy, really. And if you can skip that step, but also use any trimmings you might have had, like they do in the Icelandic walls, you're keeping all that volume within the structure. So effectively what they've done in these Roman fortifications is put the turfs in again upside down. They didn't trim them. They just covered them with a layer of mortar, put these branches in, and then put on a next layer. So you're very quickly creating this big volume of material that has it's effectively timber laced.
Yeah.
So it's very strong, which of course for military use is great. And I had my suspicions about the use of mortar previously, but we don't really have the resolution, the archaeological resolution to confirm that. But certainly in the Netherlands, along the west coast, square turfs were used, a peaty turf, so a turf that would have shrunken a lot. And in order to stay on top of that shrinkage, ideally you would dry the turfs beforehand, or it could even have been turf that was dug up from canals or ditches, as they did in later periods for use as a fuel. They would dredging is the word I was looking for. They dredge peat from the water, cast it on the side, and like you'll have seen how in some countries, certainly in the Middle East, till recently, mud blocks were made, and you get these whole fields of mud blocks all one next to each other. This process would have produced a similar image where they cast out this dredged peat, and then as it starts to dry, they cut it up in blocks and allow them to shrink individually. That was used later on as a fuel, but you could produce similar peat bricks for building purposes.
Yeah.
Of course, the side effect of it is that they warp as they dry. They twist and warp. So you need to use a mortar, really. Once they dry, they're so hard, you can't trim them like you do with a fresh turf. So you need to find a sort of workaround solution for that. And mortar just seems like a great solution to it.
It is,
But that's really just at a hypothesis level, still awaiting confirmation. And it's great that now here in Scotland they're finding evidence for similar use in Roman structures. It just adds to the variety of techniques involved in turf construction. Of course, the implication is also that people were very knowledgeable about the use of turf. They would have had a lot of experience, and they knew exactly how to adapt their techniques to what type of turf was available and what they were trying to build with it. And that doesn't happen if it's only used occasionally or if people don't invest in it mentally. It's like any craft work. Craftspeople are constantly working to achieve to improve their techniques and their results. And I think the variety of turf techniques demonstrates that same process was on the go in the past for the use of turf.
Yeah. I wonder if it was sort of generational. You know, your elders would teach you to build with the local soil, turf, and then you would teach the younger generations.
Yeah. And that, of course, that process of handing down knowledge and experience, that's been broken. And we lost that knowledge. I think we can relearn a lot of things, and experimental archaeology is a great way of achieving that.
I'd like to come back and talk about experimental archaeology a little bit more, but while there's a couple of things I wanted to ask you. Am I right in thinking Hadrian's Wall? Is some of that turf?
Yeah, some of it definitely.
So that's quite a big thing that people will have.
Yeah.
I think everyone probably in the UK has heard of Hadrian's Wall, and now find out it's made of turf.
Yeah, Hadrian's Wall definitely. Antonine Wall used a lot of turf. In fact, a lot of fortifications in the Iron Age, Viking period fortifications, turf is a great material to build with for volume. Yeah.
And then how quick does it sort of, an ecological point of view, how quick does it grow back and, the area you've de-turfed?
Deturfed is a word.
When will that be ready again to be sort of harvested again.
It really varies per site, and we don't actually know that in any great detail. It's one of the questions that's still out there, and certainly as we're now looking into using turf for new builds, it's a question that's become more current. We're now setting up a project to test some of these things, a project funded by Historic Environment Scotland, to look at the use of vernacular building techniques and take an archaeo-based approach to small-scale new builds, hutting in particular.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, that's very exciting. And one of the elements in that project, University of Edinburgh, well, it's actually a separate project I'm running with them, but it's very closely linked and we're focusing on the same site. Ecological impact assessment is an important part of that process. So hopefully by creating a species list beforehand and revisiting the site, maybe a couple of years afterwards, we'll get a better idea of the impact cutting turf has had on the landscape. The only thing I can really say about that at the moment is just that the positive response I got from the nature organization in the Netherlands. Of course, when we set out to build, this was a 17-meter long turf wall building. The walls were 2 meter high, they were a meter thick. So I was there as a young student approaching this big organization in the north of the Netherlands saying, can I please cut 200 square meters of turf from your recognized natural conservation area just outside the sea dikes? And they said, yes, please, because one of their issues, as it turned out, was that this was just used as pasture. It was a monocultural pasture land. That was grazed by horses and sometimes cattle. And they welcomed us cutting the turf because it created a habitat for pioneer vegetation to establish itself in that area. And indeed, when I returned a year later, there were flowers in that area where previously there was only grass. That's one option, that the turf helps to create a habitat that's not present in the pasture at the moment. It could help to deepen ponds that have silted up. So as ponds, certainly with sort of slow, low flow rates of water, might silt up gradually or through peat growth. So cutting turf in those areas might locally help to create open water again. So for dragonflies or other insects that might use that habitat on wetland areas with a firmer soil. So maybe in floodplains that flood occasionally and then drain again, might be usable as summer pastures or hay areas for producing hay. If we cut turf there, you create little pools that might function as effectively wader scrapes. So one of the conservation interventions that landowners can even get subsidies for is to create wader scrapes. And these are just narrow strips, maybe 40 meters long, where they take in a mechanical digger and scrape back a bit of the soil. I'm not sure where the soil then goes. I guess it just gets piled up on the side. We can achieve the same effect by hand cutting turfs and then using that as a building material to the same effect. So these are various lines that we're exploring to not only to legitimize the use of turf and cutting it from natural environments, but particularly to find out where the benefit in that lies and how the sourcing of materials in a natural environment can be beneficial to wildlife in particular.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It seems like it ties in with what Sid Hill was talking about in his podcast episode 51 or 2. Check that one out. That was my attempt at being a proper podcast host, by the way.
I should be a proper podcast listener. I've listened to so many and I've fallen behind massively, certainly over lockdown. I think podcast listening works particularly well when you're up for a long drive.
That's that, exactly when
that
I
didn't
listen.
Happen during lockdown.
Yeah.
So there's much catching up to do.
Yeah. I've sort of broken the habit a little bit now. I've made more than I've listened to in the last year, that's for sure. Yes, he was talking about sort of succession of plants and how it's the disturbance that kind of creates new growth. I've been, so this coming weekend there's an event to trespass on the South Downs, and at the sort of information event, someone asked the question, you know, what about the damage we're going to be doing by walking across all that land? And actually the sort of response was that it's the, quite often it's that disturbance, like it used to maybe be people taking sheep on and off, or, you know, it's around those tracks where the feet sort of, you know, disturb the ground that you get the new growth, you get the diversity. And actually, you know, it's a really
definitely.
Positive thing.
The landscape in which we live, although it has many natural elements, it's an ecological landscape in that sense. It's also definitely a cultural landscape. Everything we see effectively has been, is a result of past human intervention in that landscape. So even from a conservation point of view, uh-huh. if you're looking to preserve our agricultural landscape as it exists now, or even moorland up in the Scottish mountains, you can only really conserve that if you include the practices that helped create it. So, and I think natural building, and certainly sort of the line of approach we're now trying to deepen out with Historic Environment Scotland and others, is to look at vernacular building skills, these pre-improvement vernacular building skills that, I mean, the skills are there. There's a conservation need in terms of building conservation to maintain these skills. There's a handful of earth builders. There's very few thatchers in Scotland, at least. Very few greenwood timber mm-hmm. builders that could produce a crook or a Scottish couple, which is quite different from later timber framing techniques. So we need to preserve these skills, but there's a very little demand for them. And they have all these additional benefits that we're now only just starting to explore. So cutting turf to create wader scrapes, or pulling bracken to produce a thatch. Maybe in itself it doesn't make much sense to pull bracken by hand, just if you're looking to produce a roof for your hut. But of course, if there's a lot of bracken pressure on a particular hillside, turning this into a community activity and going out to pull bracken collectively, it's a great way of spending time together, but also reducing that bracken cover, for which only alternatives are to bruise it, which then takes a long time to actually have a significant impact, or to spray poison on it. So hand pulling
That's really interesting. So the woodland I'm just about to put my house into has a whole big bracken, and part of my job is to be, you know, bruising the bracken to allow the new trees to sort of take hold and have less competition. But so thatching is a thing I could be doing with
definitely
with that,
and it's
instead.
Much more effectively, because for thatching you actually want the woody bit at the bottom of the stem. That's the most durable. So you pull the mm-hmm. bracken by hand, which of course is labor intensive to do. If you make that into a fun activity, and you can call on social capital to do that, it has a bigger positive impact.
Well, excellent. Everyone listening, you know, keep your ears open for the shout when I get you to come and hang out in Exmoor pulling bracken with me. It'll be fun. Okay, so just one final thing on turf that I wanted to say, and it was something that Phil Christopher really highlighted to me the other day, was that the soddies, the turf houses in Nebraska, I had never seen the connection, but I see them now very much as, I mean, they were the sort of step towards straw bale homes. They were taking this building with sod, which is what Americans call turf. Sorry, I'm telling the listeners, not you there.
I'm just nodding in agreement.
I don't want you to think like this is your specialist subject. I'm not. I'm just scratching the surface. So they were building these soddies, and then they had loads of the sort of farming byproduct of straw, and so took the techniques on to build straw bale houses. And yeah, that's the first straw bale houses were load bearing houses because the soddies were. I find like, you know, I'm suddenly now I know the heritage of it. Because I always thought sort of straw bale, it didn't really exist until 100 years ago. And it feels like the sort of new kid in town. But actually now I see it as part of a much longer development. It sort of gives it a bit more legitimacy, it's really, I think.
Sprout out of nothing. So they'll have some sort of pedigree to them that goes back. And it's retracing those lines of development, which can be very interesting. In terms of turf building or sod building, as indeed it's called in the United States or in Ireland, the spectrum of material used within turf is just so wide. So straw, of course, is only organic fibres. A peat turf is no different. It doesn't need to have any mineral sediments in it. When we looked at the salt marsh turf in the Netherlands, it had very little organic material in it, and it was mostly the clay that held it all together. So that's just the full width of the turf building spectrum. And it merges. You can see it as something quite different, as you can see earth building quite different from modern construction. How different really is earth building using clay as a binder compared to the use of a lime mortar or in fact cement mixes. They're all based on the same tradition in the end. Although of course a mistake we've made in the recent past is to replace one technique with another and to not hold on to what we already had and add to that richness and experience from past societies. Mm-hmm. But,
yeah, and see the multi layers of sort of benefit beyond just a home, just a, you know, whether it's new value, whether it's, you know, waterproof, whether it's or length of expected life. It seems like we've lost a whole lot more than just. Yeah,
well, so our building in the Netherlands, our house the brick and concrete one. Or rather, the one that it replaced that had a lifespan of 40 years, as it turned out. In archaeology, certainly in the Netherlands, in the literature, we say past farm buildings were disposable buildings because they had such a short lifespan. They only lasted for about one or two generations. In fact, a lot of the research is showing that they lasted up to about 70, 80 years. So closer to three generations. And certainly longer than a lot of the modern buildings we're building.
Mm-hmm.
But these structures that we're looking at through the archaeological lens were using locally sourced timber and clay, and they melted back into the countryside, leaving very few traces. Whereas our modern structures, are they doing the same? It doesn't seem to be the case. And I think for a long time, the argument's been made that, again, going back onto this whole improvement paradigm, that we were improving living conditions in modern buildings and improving comfort levels. There's no reason why a thatched mud wall building should be any less comfortable than a modern structure. In fact, I think a lot of people have switched on to things now and realized that a natural building will in fact be a lot more comfortable than a hard, echoey, concrete-based structure you might find in modern developments.
Yeah, and certainly to do with sort of moisture and comfort around moisture. If you're surrounding yourself with a living, natural part of the world, you know, it's going to deal with moisture in a way that's more in tune with how, you know, what our bodies want and need. Seems pretty,
absolutely
seems yeah. pretty sensible. Yeah. Do you see there to be a sort of future in new build turf buildings?
In the past, in fact, I have answered that question with a definite no. I remember somebody quite clearly asking me that when we started building the turf house reconstruction in the Netherlands. Now I definitely think there's a use for it. I keep going on about this whole hutting thing, which may not be, maybe not everybody will be familiar for that, but the construction of huts for leisurely use is something that's been stimulated more and more within Scotland.
Yes,
in
the Thousand Huts campaign.
Exactly. So yeah. There's now hutting planning legislation in place to allow people to build this hut, a structure no bigger than 30 square meters that needs to sit lightly on the land. Very basic services, just a fireplace really and a composting toilet outside. And ideally, you'd build these in places either in woodland or up in the hills. And immediately if you start looking into that or trying to build such a structure, you think, well, how are we even going to get access? Sitting lightly on the land is one thing, but how am I going to get my bricks up there or concrete block work? I can't get a lorry in. So certainly for those circumstances, cutting turf locally could be a great workaround. There's generally a small quantity of stone kicking about, either sort of localized field clearance, just being able to pick up field boulders on the surface. Alternating stone and turf is one other technique that was widely used in the past, and it works very well with rounded field boulders or any of these glacial boulders that aren't really suitable to building dry stone structures because they keep rolling down. you can use them fairly well with turf in between.
Yeah.
Clay with a lot of straw mixed in, as they did in Aberdeenshire in the past. Clay and bull, it's called. I think Becky referred to that technique, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, yeah.
And so that's something you can use locally, and all these materials can be collected on site and brought in, and then the upper structure can be built in turf. So, there's definitely
that's exciting
a place for them. Yeah. And they appeal to this particular audience. Scottish black houses, Scandinavian log cabins, Icelandic turf farms feature regularly in imagery shared on the various platforms on Facebook and the hutting forums.
Mm-hmm.
So they do appeal to the people, although of course if they try and achieve such a build, they'll find that they can't find the skills for it. Those are the skills we need to develop.
Great. Well, speaking of which, you've got some workshops coming up, haven't you?
We do have some workshops coming up, yeah, in turf, as it happens. It's once you get into turf, it's hard to get out. as I said, we're really looking at pre-improvement vernacular building skills more generally. I think the best way forward, certainly in the short term, is to try and move away from the high degree of specialization that we've achieved, really focusing on individual materials or techniques. So you're a plasterer, or you're a thatcher, or you're a slater. And of course, in pre-improvement vernacular buildings, you do a bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the route we're trying to take towards using vernacular techniques in hutting. So timber, thatching, clay plasters, turf building, the whole lot.
Great.
But turf does appeal greatly to me and thankfully to people in the in the wider community.
Yes, definitely.
So we're doing a turf course as part of Doors Open Days this year. Of course, it's a big word. It's really just an interactive workshop. So that's sponsored through University of Edinburgh, their archaeological department, who are also seeking new ways to apply archaeological knowledge and experience for the benefit of modern sustainable building. So I'm working with them and the Crieff and Strathern Museum, a local heritage museum I'm involved with, and ahead of this, those open days, we'll build a larger circular structure based on local Iron Age and Bronze Age roundhouse traditions. And then we'll have a small additional workshop to get involved with later on. And the second turf course, which is a very exciting one, is with an equally exciting new initiative by the Falkland Estate and Centre for Stewardship in Fife in Scotland. They're looking to set up a new natural building school. And this first year, we're running three workshops, one of which will be delivered by Becky Little. So anybody with an interest in clay plaster and decorative clay plastering, watch this space. And my course will be on turf. And we're going to raise the bar. We're going to cover everything from foundations and these sort of early formwork-based techniques to the rectangular blockwork for solid turf wall construction, as well as the sort of double-skinned Icelandic techniques. And we're going to build a bridge.
Ooh.
So a fully turf bridge. It's the first workshop where I'm actually showing up on site with no building materials.
Shovel.
Just the tools.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exciting. Where can people find out about these?
In the show notes. That's where.
Great.
In the show notes.
Oh, very good.
We'll make sure. We'll have to. Yeah. Word still needs to get out, so okay. It's early days, right. But we'll make sure to put a link in the show.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Hall, host of Sustainable Futures, Kantar's regular look at the intersection between brands, consumers, and sustainability. I want to help you to get your brand ready for the future, understand where you can make an impact, and make a smarter business case for products and services that are better for people, the planet, and for business. Sustainable Futures will showcase what great sustainable marketing looks like and the issues that matter to consumers across the globe. Subscribe to Sustainable Futures from Kantar, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you so much, Daniel. You were a wonderful guest, and I'm so pleased with how that all turned out. There is another 25 minutes going up on the Patreon site. If you are a supporter, you get access to that. Daniel talks a little bit more about experimental archaeology. He also talks about his own project. I was really hoping to squish that in, but really we overran as it was. So I'm hoping to get Daniel back on the podcast to chat again. He's up to some interesting and exciting projects that I look forward to hearing how they've gone. Okay, so all the usual things. If this is your first time, make sure you subscribe in whatever podcast listening device you use. If you are listening on iTunes or Apple, then I would really, really love it if you could go and leave a review. Hit 5 stars, say something nice if you like. That would be really appreciated because it really does help us to get new listeners. What else to say? Share it, of course. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share. Again, the further we can get this out, the better. I think the more people that know about natural materials, the better the world's going to be. I think that's becoming pretty clear with the IPCC report. Some serious changes need to happen. And maybe starting with sharing a little podcast could be that. Good. That's it. Thanks for listening. Until next time. See ya.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Hall, host of Sustainable Futures, Kantar's regular look at the intersection between brands, consumers, and sustainability. I want to help you to get your brand ready for the future, understand where you can make an impact, and make a smarter business case for products and services that are better for people, the planet, and for business. Sustainable Futures will showcase what great sustainable marketing looks like and the issues that matter to consumers across the globe. Subscribe to Sustainable Futures from Kantar, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.